This is a critical election. Again, Amy provides both sides to the whys and why not people take actions. If you appreciate this level of journalism, if you appreciate this platform for this voice, for these voices, 202-588-9739. Coming up next will be the wonderful E. Ethelbert Miller and On the Margin. But meanwhile, Democracy Now! Is the only show that we have broadcasting on a daily basis here. If it is something you've come to rely upon, do support it. 202-588-9739. You're tuned to Member Supported Radio, WPFW Washington. Thank you in advance for your support.
Recording in.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Daniel Simon. Daniel Simon is a poet, translator, and essayist. He is assistant director and editor-in-chief of World Literature Today. His most recent book is Under a Gathering Sky, published by Stephen F. Austin State University Press. How are you doing today, Daniel?
Good morning, Ethelbert. I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Oh, great. We have to have you on the show, okay? And while you're on the show this morning, we'll be doing our pledge drive and encouraging people to call 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. Daniel, the first poem in your book, Under a Gathering Sky, I feel is very timely. It touches on borders, immigration, as well as our spiritual relationship to one another. I wonder if you could read that poem and talk a little bit about it as we, you know, sort of break bread this morning.
Thank you, Ethelbert. I'd be delighted to share it with you and your listeners. Under a Gathering Sky, after Lucille Clifton. If we are required to view it together through cut glass eyes, what story would the accurate album tell? If textbooks whitewash history and the dead tell true tales, what manifests, destiny or complicity? Pictures in an album construct narratives less about accuracy than sudden flashes of truth, less about gathering than frames cutting into pieces are witnessing, such skies that cry out, were you not there with blood on your hands?
Okay. I want you to go back and read Declaration at the Border, because that's the first poem in your book. And then,
okay.
Okay. All right. So let's do that one too.
Sure. Let's do that one as well. Declaration at the Border. Mm-hmm. Enter the new country, writes Nouwen. The country of love, the country of memory, the country of crossing over. Yet we linger on the border. Does our beloved dwell within or without? Clinging tightly to ideas we once held, we cradle them in our arms as we stand on the threshold. At the checkpoint, fear screams at us to turn around. The country of the future doesn't care about our papers, nor does it matter what past we declare or on whose authority we present ourselves. The allegiances we claim will decide our fate. Raising our hands, we profess what we believe will permit us to pass. Yet the guard demands only loyalty, not belief. Just beyond the edge of vision, we declare something we cannot see, but one day hope to hold again.
Okay. Let's talk about, you know, you read the Lucille Clifton poem that was inspired by Lucille Clifton, Under the Gathering Sky, and you read this Declaration at the Border. I'm looking at these poems together. But let's talk about the Declaration at the Border first, because you are in Norman, Oklahoma. You're close to Texas and New Mexico. How have you been affected by the issue of immigration, which is so much part of the discussion during the presidential election?
Well, historically, of course, Oklahoma has been a crossroads of indigenous nations, African-American migration, Hispanic and other immigrants into this territory that was once Indian territory and only became a state in 1907. So we have this sort of compressed history that really makes Oklahoma's history kind of a crucible for American history writ large. And I would just say, you know, in one of, in a very conservative state, the politics of immigration are very vexed here. We're not directly on the US-Mexico border, but there's just a lot of rhetoric around illegal immigration and everything else that comes with that, especially in this particular political election season. So really for me, it's more about these historical migration patterns of Anglo-American settlement within this particular territory that already had ancestral, was an ancestral homeland for many other nations and peoples throughout history.
You know, I kept coming back to your line, the country of the future doesn't care about our papers. You know, I felt that that was something which, when we look at immigration and migration around the world, you know, I think that's a very important line.
Thank you. Yeah, I really envision this particular poem. You know, obviously it's about political borders, but I also wanted to be kind of an embodiment or an embodied poem about what it feels like to live in fear at these thresholds, whether it's an immigrant or just someone who's on a spiritual quest and trying to cross over to another space or time. So, you know, having papers permits us to pass if we're lucky, you know, but as I say in the poem, the guard demands loyalty, not belief. So, it's a very, it's always, you know, these threshold moments are always, have so many resonances, not only for our politics, but for, our personal journeys.
You know, I know that it's probably some of our listeners who are writers, and many times we put together a manuscript and we have to decide the placement of poems. This poem is first. Why is this poem first? Is this like the, you know, like the sort of like the appetizer of what's coming in the book? I mean, but is this, you know, you had a choice. I mean, I could see this book being in the center of your manuscript.
That's a great question. This manuscript really came together over the past 5 years, and I don't know if this, I don't think this was the first poem I wrote, but as I was putting it together, I called this first section Auguries, and you know, so having the very first poem in the book be a declaration, you know, by declaring something, we're kind of staking out our claims for what it is we want to want our readers to see as they're encountering the poems. And so I just thought this particular, you know, as a border into the book, as a declaration of my aesthetic and you know, poetic ambition, I thought it was a good way to offer a point of entry into the collection.
I'm surprised you say auguries as opposed to omens, which, is, which would sort of like cast a spell on the rest of the book.
Indeed. Indeed.
Okay, well, let's look at, you know, I asked you to read these, you know, Declaration at the Border, which you just read, and also Under a Gathering Sky. And I want to look at, how do you see these poems interact? Because I look at them where we're talking about migration, and this poem that you have, which is inspired by Lucille Clifton's work, her poem is a photograph, a lynching. So it seems that when we were talking about, you know, ancestry and memory and things of that sort, well, this is part of American history.
Indeed, and speaking of omens, there's a photograph on the cover of the book that's by Michael Forsberg, that it's from the sandhills of Nebraska. It's very picturesque in many ways, but these dark clouds that kind of loom on the horizon, I think that kind of haunts the book in many ways. And of course, in Clifton's case, you know, her poem about lynching really is an important poem to reference in terms of the title of the book. Under a Gathering Sky is a line of hers, and something about the rhythm of that particular phrase. It's a dactylic phrase, under a gathering sky. And so within this horrific poem, or within this poem about a horrific act, there's also the artistry of Clifton writing about it. And having grown up as a drummer in a jazz band and a pep band and a marching band, I'm always attracted to rhythm. And so that, the rhythm of that particular phrase caught my ear, and now that as I was writing this particular poem, Oklahoma was coming up on the centennial of the Tulsa Race Massacre. And that, of course, was a community lynching that resulted in the deaths of hundreds of residents of Greenwood. And so I think that was in the back of my mind at the moment as we were writing, as I was writing that poem and thinking about Clifton and the act of photography and these infamous postcards of lynchings that were sold after the fact. So all of that, I think, kind of works its way into the poem.
Well, I'm going to read the poem by Lucille Clifton, A Photograph of Lynching. Is it the cut glass of their eyes looking up towards the new gnarled branch of the black man hanging from a tree? Is it the white milk pleated collar of the woman smiling towards the camera, her fingers loose around a Christian cross drooping against her breast? Is it all of us captured by history into an accurate album? Will we be required to view it together under a gathering sky? And so that's Lucille Clifton. You talk about not just writing poems with Clifton, but also other people. And you talk about this slant interpretation. What do you see when we look at this poem here that you were in dialogue with Lucille Clifton? Was there a particular line? Were you dealing with Lucille's, were you dealing with the subject matter? I know that sometimes what pulls a writer together, you know, to talk to another writer is because the person is well known if they're one of their favorite writers. So I think you have like Emily Dickerson, like, you know, you're like discussion with. So talk about Lucille Clifton and some of the other writers that you have this sort of relationship on the page with.
Yeah, there's a whole section in the book called Dialogues that include homage as well as poems in conversation with Gerard Manley Hopkins, Emily Dickinson, contemporary poets like Robert Haas, Lucille Clifton, of course, and others. And, you know, as an editor, I'm constantly reading the work of other writers and trying to showcase that work in the pages of World Literature Today, the magazine that I've been editing for so many years. And so I'm always, I feel like in my own work, I'm thinking about the work of others and how it builds on that poetic tradition. And in Clifton's case, I think that particular poem, something about the imagery, and of course the title is The Photograph, and how we as witnesses look on history and look on an act of violence like lynching, and how the photograph frames specific aspects of what we witness, and then there are the things beyond the frame that we don't see. And in this moment of the centennial of the Tulsa Race Massacre, my colleague Carlos Hill was editing a book on the photographic history of the massacre, and there's this really disturbing photo of white Tulsans walking with picnic baskets toward Greenwood the day after the neighborhood was burned down and hundreds of people were killed, and almost as if they were going on a, you know, a Sunday afternoon picnic. So there are these moments of witnessing that are, I think, really at kind of at the heart of Clifton's poem that I'm trying to grapple with and reckon with in my own.
Let me focus on something which I'm thinking about. Looking at you as say you're drawn to this poem. You know about what's going on in history. It seems as if you could say I'm a poet of witness, but when I'm reading the Lucille Clifton poem, it's witnessing, you know, because she's actually describing. So I could be a writer in solidarity, say I'm a writer witness, you know. But within this particular poem, she's actually recreating, so you're witnessing something that, you know, it's different for the writer because you're writing a poem about somebody who's actually seeing an actual, she's actually there, even though it's taken from a photograph.
Right. So there's that primary witnessing, and then the secondary witnessing that's refracted through her work and the artistry that she brings to the page in representing atrocity, but then at the same time having the language under the weight of that witnessing, do the work that it needs to do to bear that truth. And so I'm really kind of, again, writing in homage to Clifton, but also trying to reckon with our own complicity as secondary witnesses to such violence.
Yeah, I saw it. This gets back to the placement of your poems. I said, well, this is interesting. How come this poem is not in sections? Why is this poem in section 3 and not 2? Because you have all these other poems that are, you know, you're in conversation with writers, but the Lucille Clifton poem is in the third section.
Yeah, I wrestled a lot with the grouping of the poems in these five different sections and tried to create an arc, you know, from start to finish. And by putting this poem in dialogue with Clifton at the very start of section 3, I really wanted to put it at the heart of the book in a way that was kind of at a different register than the other poems.
Well, that's
dialogue
the part. And
with
we can hear it beating. We can hear the heart beating. My guest this morning is Daniel Simon, and we've been talking about his book, Under a Gathering Sky. If you're listening to our show and enjoying our show, you could call 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, and make a pledge. I think, Sotiria, are you in the station right now?
Hi, how are you doing this morning, Ethelbert?
Good. You want to join? Daniel's on is my guest this morning, and we're talking about poetry.
Well, good morning, Daniel, and thank you, gentlemen, for having me. I just want to remind the audience of a few things. First of all, we are in our fall pledge drive. Our goal this hour is $500, so we want to give the number again, and that is 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. You can also click donate now at our website, and that is wpfwfm.org, or cash app us at $WPFWFM. We are looking for $500 in contributions this hour, as well as 5 new members. And we want to remind the audience that poetry allows the expressing of emotion. And through these carefully chosen words, it speaks to universal themes of love, loss, hope, and resilience. In other words, the human experience. In today's society, I know it feels so highly segmented. And we have to be brought back to the fact that, yes, we all do have some common experience. And poetry allows us to see that. And while still celebrating our diversity, this is also the power of WPFW. And if you appreciate that here at WPFW, that we bring you this show, this wonderful show, Ethelbert is it's a phenomenal program. Each and every week we're hearing from artists. And it's amazing that we have a platform to be able to share this information with you. And if you value that, if you want to continue to hear it, if you appreciate the expression of diverse voices on WPFW, we ask you to give us a call, show your financial support, 202-588-0999. Oh, I'm sorry. That's the office number.
we can reach you there. See, that's how you put your hand in the kitty.
Isn't it? It's 202-588-9739. Or our website is wpfwfm.org, or cash app us at WPFWFM. We also ask that you consider becoming a sustainer for as little as $20 a month. That $20 a month comes out of your bank account. You don't have to think about it. We withdraw it. And that counts as $240 a year to WPFW. That means your small donation of $20 a month grows and becomes a huge difference at WPFW. So we invite you to join our sustaining program if that's something you would be interested in. You could, hey, we've got a goal of $500. I know that some of you out there have the means and value WPFW as well as on the margin enough to donate that type of money. But either way, however you give, pick up your phone, go to your computer, make your donation to WPFW. 202-588-9739 or wpfwfm.org.
Okay, thank you, Centurion. Okay. Daniel Simon, let me ask you to read another poem. Not another poem, about poetry, if you could read that.
Sure, let me pull up the page here. Not another poem about poetry. Just another verse, taking up words in the mind, lines on a page, pages in a book, books on a shelf, shelves upon shelves, like overlapping waves, not quite straight but curved, drawing the gloaming horizon over itself, patterned against shadows on the mind's canvas, small constellation of making, unmaking, making anew.
You're listening to Daniel Simon reading from his book, Under a Gathering Sky. Daniel, when I look at this poem, it's 11 lines, but what I was looking at is that the lines actually have this curvature, you know, in on the page. And I was wondering, was that by design?
Yes, I was thinking about the curvature of the horizon, the curvature of standing on the shore of a body of water, you know, living on the southern plains here. The horizon is always right there in terms of our consciousness of the weather patterns, the seasons of migration, and everything else that you know, that is right there outside our window. So I really thought that this particular poem could kind of represent how that straightness gets curved in different ways in the context of these particular words as they're arranged on that, the white frame of the page.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to move from that point to ask you a question. What poetic forms do you find attractive as a poet and also as an editor?
I probably, for the most part, you know, enjoy free verse, but I would say, you know, historically, the sonnet, the, you know, the challenge as a writer of working within the constraint of a classical form like that really has been, you know, kind of a discipline for me not to be too loose on the page. But really, I would say, you know, all of the, you know, from the epic poets to today, the contemporary poets who are working in various forms, especially doing really interesting visual arrangements of words on the page, but also the embodied voice that you hear as you're reading in silence. But if you're at a poetry reading, you get to hear these poems enacted in embodied. So I think there's that kind of, in this book, I really wanted to kind of draw on kind of a muscular, oral Anglo-Saxon diction. I was reading Beowulf earlier this summer and last year as well, and just thinking about how the language has been shaped by so many influences and draws on, and I try to draw on that in my poems.
Yeah, see, that's why I was asking. This is like a trick question. I was asking a question because many times what happens is that an editor has work that they like, okay? So, and we're at a point now that I could look at all the magazines you've been editing since 2008, run that through a little data thing and realize that, okay, you like more sonnets than villanelles or something like that. So now as a person contributing to your journal, knowing what you like, I send in my sonnets because I want to get published, you know. But I say that because sometimes, you know, an editor shows a certain bias, you know. Mm-hmm. And I remember me and my friend Jody Bowles, we were editing Poet Laureate for a long time. And we try to make sure that, you know, we challenge our likes, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, we wouldn't want a person to pick up their journal and say, oh, I know that they're not going to like my work, you know, and so you don't even send them work in. You want to make sure that, okay, even though I might like a particular thing, I will step outside of myself and meet the person halfway, you know. And I feel this is the same way if you're editing a magazine or you're reading grant applications. You shouldn't mm-hmm. say, okay, I'm going to deny somebody money because they're not writing what I want to see.
Yeah. Thanks for that trick question. But I,
okay.
As you know, as an editor, you're trying to triangulate your audience and your mission as a publication and with those writers and artists and other contributors who you're bringing into conversation in your pages. And so, you know, as a magazine of world literature, we're always trying to expand the boundaries of genre and gender and geography and language, mm-hmm. especially through translation in our pages. And yeah. so that's really our remit as a publication. And so, you know, as I'm reading new submissions all the time, I'm trying to, as you say, put aside my biases and my predilections and to look for something that's new and exciting that can really speak to our readership.
And because you said that, that sounds like a nice lead into the next poem after reading everything.
Okay.
You're an international publication.
Thank you. Okay. Shall I read it for you?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is after rereading everything. My previous book was called After Reading Everything. Right. So I'm playing on that. You know, as I reach this kind of late middle age moment in my life, after rereading everything, that shelf of books along the wall looks quite different in middle age, Il Mezzo del Cammin and all that, than it did in my 20s when I only began to realize how little I'd ever read. Having gone down that path more than double the length, I know now that the measure of purgatory is not so much in the steep ascent that still lies ahead than in the temptation to look back on all the books I'll never read. The self-winnowing shelf jettisons the books that cause it to sag. The spines of all the rest stand a little straighter, knowing that the winnowing still to come will happen in the thin air where step labors to follow step.
You're listening to Daniel Simon reading from his book, Under a Gathering Sky. Daniel, I want to know, how do we measure our lives in books?
A great question. I, you know, as growing up looking at you know, picture books and reading fables and fairy tales, and you know, we listen to our mothers and fathers read to us and others, you know, elders in our lives who maybe put books in our hands and say, you need to read this. And so we go through this process of kind of absorbing print culture and then embracing our own individuality as readers at a certain stage. And, you know, as a poet, my brother Dave put a book of Yeats into my hands and when I was still in high school, and I didn't really read a lot of poetry before that, but something about The Wild Swans at Kool, for example, just really captured my attention and my imagination. So I started reading more poetry in college, you know, Yeats, Eliot, Stevens, Bishop, and other American and international poets, and also tried to start writing my own. And so I didn't think I was a very good poet, so I put that back on the shelf and then kept reading and reading and reading until I thought I was ready to write again. And so maybe in the past dozen years or so, I've been really actively writing poetry again. And this particular book took about 5 years to put together. And of course, it has some of the pandemic in it, but a lot of these dialogues about with other poems are nods to literary tradition, but also kind of the arc of time as we age and our readers, our tastes change as readers, how we look back upon that path or that ascent and then go on reading and reading again. So of course Dante's right there in the middle of that, you know, on the path with Virgil. So there's that kind of classical background to this particular book. I've noticed more and more as I've been rereading it and other poets as well. So you have these companions that accompany you on the journey, but then you at a certain point move beyond and hopefully pay forward that kind of cultural capital that you've inherited from them.
How has your reading habits changed outside of poetry? Are you reading more books about architecture or, you know, anthropology?
I was reading during the pandemic, I was reading W.G. Sebald, his great novel, Austerlitz, Barry Lopez, his book called Arctic Dreams. And that particular book really made a strong impression on me, and how he talks about how we were estranged from the beauty of the land, but then hopefully we are reconciled to the land as part of this broader ecosystem of nature. So I would say, you know, kind of reading beyond the poetry that I typically read, some of those books have, were really part of the background to this book and how it inspired me to think of these poems, and also my work as a translator, I think, has brought into the work as well.
Before we take our break, I want to ask you one last question. What do you, I'll use you as an example, you know, what do you do with your library? I mean, this is what I'm dealing with right now. You know, you have all these books, you know, our children are into like online reading, things of that sort. What's happening with your collection?
My collection is I'm winnowing it. I'm always trying to, you know, I've got shelves all around in my office here at home and at on campus, and there's just, of course, you know, the making of many books, there is no end to that, but the reading, the process of selection and curation over time, you kind of make your own library, and so it's fun to kind of look back at some of the books you've read over the years and then realize, okay, I need to put that one aside or sell it or donate it, and then before I add anything new.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully people will be listening to us and will be adding things new to WPFW. And so we're going to take a little break here. The station is WPFW. We're in our fundraising drive, and the number to call to make a pledge is 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739. Help us make our goal this hour. And the station is WPFW 89.3 FM. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller.
Fall is a time of change and impermanence. What never changes is WPFW's unwavering commitment to providing reliable news, informative public affairs, and exceptional music that inspires both action and introspection. From October 14th through November 3rd, we celebrate The Circle Unbroken, 47 years of being in the community with WPFW during our fall pledge drive. We invite you to be in community and solidarity with us by making a donation at WPFWFM.org to ensure that this independent grassroots media outlet not only survives, but thrives. It is with your generous support that we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Daniel Simon. He's the author of Under a Gathering Sky. Daniel, WPFW is, you know, we love jazz here. And so I thought, you know, we would have you read Song from My Father's Father, you know, which is, I guess, a Horace Silver quintet.
Sure. This is called Song from My Father's Father, which there's Song for My Father's, one of Silver's famous albums, and so this is again sort of an homage to fathering and to jazz. Song for My Father's Father, after Horace Silver. He listened to opera in a tie and overalls, according to family lore, some Sunday afternoon respite from the week-long toil of farming. Did his parents bring such cultural sophistication? Did his parents bring such cultural touchstones with them to buff a veneer of sophistication over their Czech peasant roots? If polkas and waltzes got their feet moving, opera and jazz moved mind and heart. Whether orchestra or combo, aria or shuffle, radio drama or prized victrola, the afternoon breeze carried notes across the cornfields, a sip of beer or wine mellowing, lulling the listener into a mellow mood, that trace of dirt under fingernails, reminder of Monday's chores to come.
Right. You know, this poem, you know, is so much of, like I think of Philip Levine, this poem is about work, you know, it's also about culture, it's about class. And I like how this poem begins. He listened to opera in a tie and overalls. You know, I mean, you know, it has a lot to do with how older people, this is a grandfather, you know, how we dress up, you know, how some people like polish, their shoes have to be polished before they go out. But there's these small things that capture, or what happens is that, you know, the holidays coming up, you put the good china out, you know, because what happens is that that's what you're supposed to, and it's passed down, you know. And I like how it says, according to family lore. I think in every household is family lore. You know, like my family was, I was supposed to be given to somebody. That's a family lore. That's why I'm a writer, to document things. I don't know. I'm making that up, Daniel. Stay with me. why don't you read the poem recipe on page 44.
Okay.
That's right.
Right on the facing page. Recipe. 1.5 cups of coffee in the morning. 1/4 cup of milk per cup, 1.5 teaspoons of sugar, enough to start the day. Half a life at 44, 3/4 of my father's life, dead at 58. Was it the proverbial half a pack a day that killed him? Measure for measure, 120/80, the ideal heart, 20/20, the perfect sight, 24/7, the daily grind, a grim calculus of attainment, declaring objectivity of quotas and deadlines, fractions that parse a life, whether racked by weight or by volume. No formula for a soul, no blueprint for dwelling, no map of the distances between our habitations at the same address.
You know, when I look at this poem, you know, it's about words and numbers that you have here. On one level, it's almost not like a list poem, but you sort of capture a person's life. You know, you're listening to the things. Would you consider this, if you were teaching a class on writing, would this be one where you would tell your students, oh, to be creative, to be adventuresome, you know, try to bring things into poems that you would not normally bring into a poem?
Yeah, if I were teaching this poem, that's a great question. I was really thinking about, you know, the factors of 44 at that particular age in my life. So this is a bit of an older poem in the book, but all the ways we think about numbers just in our daily life. But, you know, as a poet, of course, you're thinking about meter and rhythm and other ways of putting words together on the page. And so I was really curious to see how that would play out, you know, from start to finish, and thinking about, again, kind of a family history in terms of my father and his life story and my own as they intersected, and how I've kind of carried that forward in ways that are a little less blue collar, but also hopefully, again, kind of I hope there's emotion and embodiment on the page, and not just intellect and wordplay.
Well, one of the things I find, if we just look at the first stanza of your poem, it's a poem about rituals. Mm-hmm. I think all of our lives begin with a ritual. You know, we wake up, we do certain things, and that sets the course of our day. But it also shows you how we get through life with these certain sense of rituals. Do you have other rituals that you do that you don't want to talk about on the air?
For me, walking is a ritual that really I would say is probably maybe the most important daily practice connected to my writing. You know, whether this morning walking around before sunrise, looking at the light on the lake, and, you know, walking my dog and thinking about, you know, our footsteps and the rhythm of our gait, little things like that are rituals that kind of ground me, get me away from words on the screen and get me out into nature. About a couple of years ago, I took my three daughters to the Central Platte Valley in Nebraska, and we watched the sandhill cranes migrating, and just seeing a ritual like that is, you know, prehistoric, in watching the full moon rise over the river that night. There was this kind of really incredible moment of seeing this migration pattern and how it connects to the human migrations that have happened all across the plains for the past centuries and millennia. And so just as a writer, you try to connect these broader kind of temporal and geographical moments with the individual work that you create on the page.
How important is it for the American writer to be connected to land and place?
I think it's absolutely vital. You know, even if you're in the city, or if you are only, you know, in your teens or 20s and haven't maybe lived as long as some of your elders have, you have a connection to wherever you live. And I think, you know, for me, nature and the rhythms of nature and seasonal migrations and, you know, growing up on a farm, that was very much a part of our identity, you know, working the land. And so I think it's really vital to have that groundedness in your work as a writer to, you know, if you're living, whether you're living right there in Washington, D.C. or here on the Southern Plains, to connect that work to something that's really anchored in the place. So,
you know, one thing that I've always felt, which would be more, I haven't seen a lot of studies of, you know, when we talk about, let's say jazz or even blues, we talk about how a particular artist moves when they say New Orleans or Chicago, how their sound changes. Mm. But I wonder, mm-hmm. how come we don't take that same analysis to say, okay, I'm writing in Oakland or LA or something like that. Now I'm in New York City. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, has my work changed?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did this. Yeah. I remember it was one writer, Jane Cortez, and Jane was out there in California with the Watch Rise Workshop. And I felt like when she came to New York, you know, like you're on a subway, you know, the sounds and it's different from looking at a tree, you know. Mm. And I just felt mm-hmm. that what happened, we don't really look at how writers change in terms of style, their work, their voice based on migration, even though this key when we talk about music.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, of course, you know, the great migration theme is right there in African-American literature. You know, but for me, you know, living here in Oklahoma for the past 20 years.
You're a Ralph Ellison guy, man.
Yeah, I mean, you think about Ellison and jazz, you know, that comes to the fore. But, you know, living here for 24 years now, about a dozen years ago, we had this terrible drought that the temperatures were over 100 degrees for like 60 days one summer. And so just thinking about the effects of climate change on the landscape here in a place like Oklahoma and what that means to the work, I think is, for me, that really kind of was the stimulus for me to start writing poetry again. And one of the first poems in my first book was called Oklahoma Burning. And so I was really affected by that particular sort of moment in my life and what it meant to live in this place and to see what was happening to it in terms of the drought and the heat and the climate change that's affecting all of us now.
Well, that's been happening out there, and it's a good way for us to talk about the publication World Literature Today. You're the 10th editor. You started in 2008. But I want to go back to when this magazine was created back in 1927, was, I think, Books Abroad. So talk about the beginning and the mission of the publication.
Yeah, I think in 1927, when Books Abroad was founded, in terms of the culture of the U.S., that was high modernism, you know, and there was a lot of sort of international cultural exchange happening, you know, across the Atlantic in particular. But in terms of the politics of the country, there was a real isolationism about in terms of the U.S.'s role in the world. And so the founding editor, Roy Temple House, who had grown up in Nebraska and was a professor here at the University of Oklahoma, he thought we needed to take that cultural richness that was happening in terms of literary modernism and bring it across, you know, from abroad to American readers and to into English. So he created this 32-page pamphlet that was mostly book reviews, but also was intended to kind of showcase what was happening on other shores. And so that was, you know, it'll be 100 years ago now, in 2025, we're starting our 99th year of continuous publication, and we've taken that mission to and really be a window to the world of contemporary international literature, and expanded it as much as possible beyond the European languages that were kind of the main focus at the beginning, to the Middle East, African, Asian writers, Latin America, and beyond. So that's really been our kind of expanding kind of global mindset over this past century now.
Well, you went from Books Abroad in 1927 to the name change in 1977, World Literature Today. What has happened since you became editor? You know, what do we give you credit for? I mean, did you start some new thing? Did you change the cover design? You know, I know, for example, when I became the editor of Poet Laureate magazine, the first thing that went out the door was people's family artwork, you know, for the covers, you know, and I felt that because we were one of the oldest literary publications, that we should have a historical look. So we went to the archives and started using photographs for our covers. But, you know, that was the contribution I think Jody Bowles and I made. But you've been editors for, you know, 2008. What are things that you say, okay, this is under my watch, this is what we're going to do or place heavy emphasis on? Did you change the design of the publication?
Not a lot in terms of the design. We switched from being a quarterly to a bi-monthly publication. We changed, as I was just starting out at WLT in 2002, this was just starting to happen in terms of creating an aesthetic that was more appealing to general readers, but also in terms of the type of writing that we were publishing, you know, the short stories, the poetry, the essays, the interviews and book reviews. We wanted it to be not too academic, but more accessible to general readers. So we, under my tenure, we've tried to make that again more broadly engaging to readers and to you know, expand our footprint globally. My particular I would say imprint on the publication is to really look at Asian and African and Middle Eastern writers. There's still a little bit of a Eurocentric approach to in the pages of the magazine, and just in how we organized the book review section. There were French and Spanish and German sections, and then Africa and the Caribbean, for example. You know, so these kind of arbitrary language and geographical distinctions we realized were a little bit colonial still in some way. So we tried to move beyond that, but also to think about, you know, what readership in the digital age means. So we're close to 2 million readers annually now, and across all our platforms. And so that expansion of our readership has been really important to me in the work that I've done.
You know, a key question I think for many editors, you know, is sustaining the publication. We've looked back and so many magazines have folded, so many newspapers have folded. How have you been able to sustain this international publication for so long?
Well, it's really, having the support of the University of Oklahoma in terms of having a place to do the work, having salary support from the university as, you know, as hard money that's enabled us to do that over the years. We have revenue from advertising and subscriptions, of course, and royalties that we funnel back into operations. So the magazine itself is self-supporting just from that revenue. And then we try to pay our contributors, you know, some modest honorarium for the work that they bring to our pages.
Okay, let me mess with you. Okay, so you said that, right?
Sure.
Okay. So I'm your new provost, and I said, oh, the magazine, do we really need that? We need more money for labs, or research. I like that model. But I do know that many times institutions come, you know, there's a change in administration or something like that. And someone says, okay, we want to go in a new direction. And you could have a really good publication, but it's not a priority.
Yeah. I mean, we've tried to maintain our connection to the teaching mission of the university. And so
we go after the teachers first.
So as, you know, as professors in the classroom, we're bringing students into the office to do internships, to give them hands-on experience. So there's there's a real vital connection there to the work that we do that's very much on the radar screen of the provost and the deans and department chairs across campus. And, you know, I would say our overall budget is kind of a drop in the bucket in terms of, you know, the emphasis on STEM and other programs here at the university, meteorology, et cetera. You know, but there's just a rich tradition of humanities and the arts here and the scholarship that's done in that regard here at the University of Oklahoma. And so we're trying to uplift that, but also maintain this kind of global connection that the university has to, you know, beyond just our place here on the Southern Plains to make sure that our readership knows about American literature, but also that we bring the world to American readers.
Let me ask you this question, which I think people are interested in the field. What characteristics or skills should a good editor have?
I would say judgment is probably the most important skill to develop, and that comes with making mistakes. You realize, you know, that you could do better over time, and you just kind of develop that skill of judgment to make good calls in terms of what you accept and what goes into your publication. I would say openness to diverse voices, new voices. And being, as we were discussing earlier, being aware of our biases, you know, as readers and editors, and also just kind of extending that teaching mission where, you know, a lot of us, as you yourself know, having been a professor and an editor, you are always trying to enlighten your readers, and you're
not only enlighten my readers, but enlighten my listeners. So I'm going to tell people, you know, that as we move come to the end of our show, we're trying. I think we need, but we just need a little bit more money, and we can reach our goal. The number here is 202-588-9739. 202-588-9739. Is Satira still there?
Yeah.
Mike?
Hey. Okay. Well, hey, Ethelbert, we want to thank Elliot Paris and Olney Maryland for the generous
Paris
contribution.
I think he's related to me.
All right. And Howard Bray in Washington, D.C., we want to thank as well. We want to thank someone from Virginia. So if you're out in Virginia, you're listening, come on, give us a call at 202-588-9739 or visit the website at wpfwfm.org. You can even cash app us at $WPFWFM. I want to let the audience know the purpose of WPFW is to be an outlet for the creative skills and energies of the community, to contribute to a lasting understanding between individuals of all nations, races, creeds, and colors, while still promoting social justice. That is the reason why poetry speaks to WPFW. That is why poetry adds and enhances to the programming here at WPFW. And if you are listening and appreciate that, we ask that you make a donation. Become a sustainer today. You can do that for $20 a month, $10 a month, $1,000 a month if your budget allows it. But we ask that you make a contribution to support On the Margin. You know, Ethelbert, he's what they say, modest. He is an acclaimed writer himself and very much recognized. And if you appreciate that he volunteers his time here to bring you these wonderful artists like Mr. Simons each and every week, give us a call, make your donation, 202-588-9739, wpfwfm.org, or Cash App. That is $WPFWFM. We only have $150 to go to meet our goal. We know we can make it today, 202-588-9739.
Daniel, one last question I want to ask you. What can we expect from World Literature Today in 2025?
In 2025, we'll have our first issue of the year devoted to the Neustadt Prize laureate, which is the $50,000 literary award that some have called the American Nobel, which this year, just last week, went to Ananda Devi, a writer from Mauritius, who will be on the subject of the cover feature. We'll do an issue devoted to Black Literary LA in the spring, and also one to the city of Delhi, India, later in the spring. And then by the summer, we'll have Guadalupe Nettel, the Mexican writer, who's coming to OU in March.
So we have something to look forward to. When
absolutely.
You say Black Literary LA, I think of my old friend, Wanda Coleman, you know, when I think of LA. Well, thank you very much, Daniel Simon, for being my guest on The Margin. The show is On The Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller, the station 33 FW 89.3 FM.
As Tuesday, November 5th approaches, the Pacifica Network is preparing to bring you relevant and resonant election night coverage. The coverage will include discussion of the most salient issues of this election cycle, as well as updates on down-ballot races, state and local initiatives, and on-the-ground reporting from coast to coast. Voter suppression, Palestine, the economy, immigration, abortion rights, and so much more are at stake with this presidential election. November 5th, 8 p.m. until midnight, you'll hear analysis, discussion, and community voices from around the country presented by the Pacifica Network. The day after, November 6th, Verna Avery Brown hosts What's at Stake, the morning after post-election coverage. That's Tuesday, November 5th, 8 p.m., and Wednesday, November 6th, 9 a.m., election coverage, as only WPFW can present it. WPFW, presenting a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Code Pink, Women for Peace, is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. It is such an exciting day. We ask you to go to the phone. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Or you can call 1-800-222-9739. That's 1-800-222-9739. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW. And it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show. You and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. If you call now 1-800-222-9739, that's 1-800-222-WPFW, or go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org, make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, 1-800-222-WPFW or go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
We're back. WPFW is excited to announce the return of the Social Justice Calendar, your go-to weekly update on the latest events, actions, and initiatives promoting equity, justice, and change across our community. The calendar's mission is to connect you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Each week, we'll spotlight rallies, workshops, forums, and community actions happening across the region. If you have an event to share, submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. please include the name, date, and address of said event in a format that is no longer than a sentence or two on Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, at least 2 weeks in advance of your event date. Space is limited, so submissions are considered in the order that they are received. The Social Justice Calendar is yet another way that WPFW connects, engages, and uplifts our community as we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Award-winning.